chapter 4, the passage that I read to you a few minutes ago. And so we have three different time periods in view in this passage. So verses 1 to 10, they describe the present. I don't mean, of course, the present from our perspective, July 2020. I mean the present from the poet's perspective. He is writing, as we've said many times, he is writing in the aftermath of Jerusalem being conquered by the Babylonians. And verses 1 to 10, like much of Lamentations, describe the aftermath of Jerusalem being conquered. They describe the grim realities which the poet sees all around him in the now ruined city. Verses 11 to 20, however, they describe the past. I don't mean the very distant past. I mean the period leading up to the Babylonian conquest. That's what those verses are about. And then verses 21 and 22, you've probably guessed it already, they describe the future, a situation that hasn't yet transpired. So that's how the passage works. And we're going to look at it this evening in those three blocks, but we're going to do so in chronological order rather than the order that they are there in the text. In the text, it goes present, past, future. We're going to take them in the order of past, present, future. And one other thing just to flag up at this point, I'm going to reserve my applications to the end this evening. Initially, we're just going to work through the passages, three blocks, clarifying exactly what has been said. And then, as I say, I'll close with a few lessons or applications that we can take away with us. So notice with me, first of all, an apparent end. An apparent end. And this is verses 11 to 20. So remember I said these verses are describing the past, and specifically the period leading up to Jerusalem's fall, the period when the city's walls hadn't yet been breached, the place is still standing, but it was under siege, a debilitating, suffocating siege. Look at verse 18. They dogged our steps so that we could not walk in our streets. That probably refers to intense lockdown conditions which prevailed in the latter stages of the siege. Listen to John L. Mackay. He says the picture seems to be one of the besieging forces keeping such close watch on what went on within the walls of the city that whenever any group tried to gather, particularly in the plazas near the city gates, they were ready to rain down missiles upon them. Verse 19 then talks about some of Jerusalem's residents who attempted to flee the siege and what happened to them. It was a case of out of the frying pan into the fire because they were ruthlessly hunted down by the Babylonian soldiers. They might seem to have a chance if they headed for the mountains. That might seem the right sort of terrain for evading capture. But no, whether they went to the mountains or to the wilderness for that matter, verse 19 says there was no escape. They were always relentlessly pursued, except that is the people focused on in verses 13 to 16, Jerusalem's prophets and priests. Despite their supposedly sacred roles, these were in fact wicked men whose murderous behavior, verse 13 seems to indicate, was actually responsible for the city's downfall. And verses 14 and 15 seem to picture then the people of Jerusalem who for too long had esteemed these wicked prophets and priests, now finally realizing that they were in fact defiled with blood, verse 14, and consequently loathing them and driving them out of the city, away, away, verse 15. And so they did leave the city. And apparently they weren't pursued by the besieging soldiers, probably because the Babylonians saw them as holy men, and in that highly religious ancient world, they respected that and so gave them safe passage, so that in verse 15 they become fugitives and wanderers. And so hopefully you're getting a feel then for these verses. They're just giving us these different snapshots of Jerusalem under siege, forced lockdown, and attempted escapes and disgraced religious leaders. There's also verse 17, of course, and this desperate hope described there that there might be an 11th hour rescue operation, probably from Egypt. That's probably the nation that's referred to there which could not save. But while some of these details then are very intriguing and fascinating, it's the atmosphere of verses 11 to 20 that I really want you to notice. It's an atmosphere of doom. Pervading the section is this sense that it's all over. The curtain is coming down on Jerusalem for good. There are three moments where that sense of doom is given particularly concrete and explicit expression. First, in verse 11, the Lord gave full vent to his wrath. He poured out his hot anger and he kindled a fire in Zion that consumed its foundations. I mean, foundations in any structure are pretty crucial, aren't they? And indispensable. And if, therefore, Yahweh is consuming Jerusalem's foundations, surely there can be no way back for the city. The second doom-laden moment is in verse 18. We've already noted the first half of the verse. Now look at the second half. Our end drew near. Our days were numbered, for our end had come. That sounds fairly unambiguous, doesn't it? Jerusalem's end. Jerusalem's end is approaching. And then the third moment is in verse 20. We saw that verse 19 is about those who attempted to flee Jerusalem during the siege. Verse 20 now moves on to the most infamous example of that trend. The king himself attempted to escape Jerusalem during the siege, King Zedekiah. And like all the others, he too failed. You can read about it in 2 Kings chapter 25. Now, Zedekiah was a disastrous king anyway. But his capture by the pursuing Babylonians, the point is, it spelt the end of Judah's monarchy, full stop. It left the throne of David empty, with no prospect of it ever being occupied again. That's what's really being mourned here in verse 20. Not so much Zedekiah himself and the loss of him, but what that represents, what that points to, the end of monarchy in Jerusalem. And look at how that loss is mourned there in verse 20. The breath of our nostrils, the poet says. The breath of our nostrils is gone. Now, if the breath of your nostrils is gone, what does that mean? Well, it usually means you're dead. And again, then, the sense of doom here is palpable. And so you can understand my heading for these verses, talking about the period leading up to the Babylonian conquest, an apparent end. Jerusalem seems to have reached the end of the road. But then secondly, a desired end. A desired end. And this is verses 1 to 10. So remember I said these verses are describing the present, the poet's present. That is the aftermath of the conquest, Jerusalem and its now ruined condition. Now some bits of this description are sobering. The reversal of fortunes, whereby those who had belonged to the higher echelons of Jerusalem society are now unrecognizable as such. Verse 5, those who once feasted on delicacies perish in the streets. Those who were brought up in purple embrace ash heaps. Verses 7 and 8, her princes, this is Jerusalem's princes, were purer than snow, whiter than milk. Their bodies were more ruddy than coral. The beauty of their form was like sapphire. Now their face is blacker than soot. They're not recognized in the streets. Their skin has shriveled on their bones. It has become as dry as wood. So some bits are sobering. Some bits are just sad. That picture in verse 1 of finding in all kinds of random places around the city stones, beautiful stones that had once graced the walls of the temple building, which now, of course, has been smashed to pieces. Some bits of the description are downright harrowing. Verse 4, the tongue of the nursing infant sticks to the roof of its mouth for thirst. The children beg for food, but no one gives to them. Verse 10, the hands of compassionate women have boiled their own children. They became their food during the destruction of the daughter of my people. The way in which, according to verse 3, the disaster has sunk the city to a lower level of civilization than you would find in a community of wild animals. Even jackals offer the breast. They nurse their young. But notice an aggravating feature of Jerusalem's ruined state here is the drawn-out nature of the situation. This is powerfully expressed at 2 points. It's expressed in verse 9. Happier were the victims of the sword than the victims of hunger who wasted away, pierced by lack of the fruits of the fields. So many of the Jerusalemites were killed when the Babylonians took the city. And that, of course, was hardly a refined and a serene way to go. But at least it was a quick way to go. At least it was over fast. One thrust of a Babylonian blade and you were gone. And you weren't around to see the mothers cooking their own children during the ensuing weeks and months and years. And then this aggravating feature is expressed most strikingly in verse 6. The chastisement of the daughter of my people has been greater than the punishment of Sodom, which was overthrown in a moment and no hands were wrung in her, would be better than for her. Sodom, of all places, that byword for extreme divine judgment. Sodom was in a more enviable position than Jerusalem, this verse is saying, because it was overthrown in a moment. This reference to wringing hands, it's a gesture, as you know, indicating great agitation. And so there was loads of it going on in Jerusalem. Now that there was no food and no sanitation and no infrastructure of any kind, but there would be no wringing of hands in Sodom because there hadn't been time for it. The whole thing was over so quickly. And you can perhaps see then why my heading for these verses is a desired end. Jerusalem, after the Babylonian conquest, would prefer to be put out of her misery than have to carry on in these dreadful conditions. It's never articulated, but hanging over verses 1 to 10 is the haunting question, why couldn't God at least have allowed the city a rapid demise? So an apparent end, a desired end, but then thirdly, an impossible end. An impossible end. And this is verses 21 and 22. And remember, I said these verses are describing the future. And in the light of everything that has preceded them in this chapter, they are utterly unexpected. Because according to these verses, the curtain is not going to come down on Jerusalem. It's not all over. According to these verses, there is light at the end of the tunnel. And while, as I say, coming like this suddenly at the end of chapter 4, these verses seem utterly unexpected. In another sense, they're not unexpected. They shouldn't be unexpected for us who have worked our way through Lamentations, because we already know, don't we, from chapter 3, that it can't be over. It can't be over for God's people. Remember verse 31 of chapter 3, the Lord will not cast off forever. That's as unambiguous as anything that's said in chapter 4. The Lord will not cast off forever. It's the nature of God's covenant love, his unbreakable commitment to his people, that there must be light at the end of the tunnel. That even Jerusalem's dreadful wickedness and the extreme chastisement that necessitated cannot have brought about the end of God having a people in this world. Such an end is impossible. God's determination to have a people bound to him in covenant must ultimately trump all other considerations. And so we have those marvelous words in these verses. The punishment of your iniquities, this is verse 22, O daughter of Zion, is accomplished. He will keep you in exile no longer. So that's the passage then, hopefully clarified to some degree at least. Well, let's spend our closing minutes looking at three exhortations by way of application. So exhortation number one, don't jump to conclusions. Don't jump to conclusions. Now, that's generally pretty good advice, I guess. But I'm thinking specifically in terms of this area, the area of interpreting what God is doing in history, interpreting what God is doing in our own lives, perhaps. Remember those great lines in William Cooper's hymn, "Judge not the Lord by feeble sense." Or again, "Blind unbelief is sure to err and scan his works in vain." And that's the kind of jumping to conclusions that I have in mind then. You see, in verses 1 to 10, as I said a minute ago, God is being seemingly rather cruel, just prolonging Jerusalem's demise. It appears as though he's just playing with Jerusalem here, playing with his people in an almost sadistic fashion, just for his own perverse pleasure. But what we discover when we come to verses 21 and 22 at the end of the chapter is that that's not the case. He's not prolonging Jerusalem's demise in order to be cruel, but because there is, in fact, not going to be a demise. He still has future plans for his people. That's why the whole saga is dragging on and on and on. Not because God is having a laugh, but because God has future plans for his people. We could put it this way. Jerusalem is right to contrast herself with Sodom, as she does in verse 6. But the contrast is not that Sodom is in a more favorable position because Sodom was put out of its misery quickly. Rather, the contrast is that Jerusalem is in a vastly more favorable position because despite being no less wicked than Sodom, despite being no more deserving than Sodom, God for some reason has made Jerusalem and not Sodom the object of his chesed, his covenant love. And therefore Jerusalem, unlike Sodom, has a wonderfully bright future. So I'm saying Jerusalem, the poet, Jerusalem, in verses 1 to 10, they're jumping to erroneous conclusions, thinking that God is just prolonging things because he's mean. And we can do that, can't we? As we look at how God seems to be dealing with us, especially when things are tough in our lives, we can get all self-pitying and we can entirely misjudge the situation. Jerusalem thought God was being cruel, needlessly prolonging her existence, when in fact he was preserving her existence for a glorious future. That's quite a misjudgment. And so we must beware, reading into our circumstances, reading into the direction history is going, the direction our lives are going, reading into those things all kinds of inferences about God that may in fact be diametrically the opposite of what is really happening. God may be doing the opposite of what we often think he is. Judge not the Lord by feeble sense. So that's exhortation number one. Don't jump to conclusions. Exhortation number two. Know how God thinks. Know how God thinks. And I'm thinking here then of that middle section, verses 11 to 20, where we said Jerusalem is under siege and the end seems apparent. And it's a question we need to ask then: how does the writer get from there to the last two verses, where, as we've said, he's confident and he's full of hope? How does he get to verses 21 and 22? Well, I think the answer to that question probably resides in a few key words that occur in the middle section. So the first word then is foundations, there in verse 11. The word foundations. And that's a pregnant word in the Old Testament in connection with Jerusalem. Particularly it evokes, remember, Psalm 87, verse 1. On the holy mount stands the city he founded. That's a verb here in verse 11 of Lamentations 4. It's the noun foundations, but in the Hebrew they're very closely connected. So that word foundations, I think it probably reminds the poets, hang on, God has established the foundations of Zion. Is it really possible then that they could be consumed irreversibly? Well, then the second key word, gates, and that's in the next verse, verse 12. The kings of the earth did not believe, nor any of the inhabitants of the world, that foe or enemy could enter the gates of Jerusalem. And again, that's a pregnant word in connection with Jerusalem in the Old Testament. Again, Psalm 87, the very next verse, the Lord loves the gates of Zion. These aren't just any old gates. These are gates that the Lord loves. Is it really feasible then that foe or enemy could enter and take over? Enter terminally, enter irreversibly the gates of Jerusalem that the Lord loves. And then the third key word, anointed, there in verse 20. And that evokes passages like, for instance, Psalm 2. And that great vision there of the Lord's anointed, who is set on God's holy hill, and who is also God's son, and who is going to inherit the nations. The ends of the earth are going to be his possession. And again, I think it triggers the thoughts, well, is it really conceivable that monarchy, Jerusalem's kingship, Jerusalem's monarchy, ends with that prophecy still unfulfilled? In other words, the poet here, he knows how God thinks. He knows what matters to God. He knows what God's priorities are. He knows that God loves the foundations of Zion, that God loves the gates of Zion, that God is passionate about his anointed king who is going to inherit the nations. He knows how God thinks, and that, I think, produces in him this confidence with which chapter 4 closes. And it's a great thing, that. It's a great thing when we know what makes God tick, what God's pulse beat is. It will affect our prayers massively. When you can argue praying for your children, when you can argue on the basis of God's commitment to the children of believers, they are holy, 1 Corinthians 7:14. You know how God thinks. He has a deep-seated interest in our children, and so you can pray passionately, arguing God's commitment. You know how he thinks. Or when you're fulfilling some ministry and you feel so weak and so inadequate and you're tempted to despair, then I can't do this. But you know how God thinks, and you know his preference for that Calvary model of doing things through weakness, through frustration, through toil. And it gives you renewed hope. And you can pray, Lord, use me then, even though I'm so weak, so weak. And so we could go on with other examples of situations where it's so useful to know, not through some intuition, but through being familiar with the scriptures, know what matters to God, what his priorities are. And you can argue those in prayer, and it will renew your hope at certain times as well. And that seems to be what happens to the poet here. He knows what matters to God. Jerusalem's foundations and gates and anointed king, and it fills him with confidence. So don't jump to conclusions, know how God thinks, but then thirdly, appreciate the big picture. Appreciate the big picture. So let's think about verse 22 there, and you might think, well, that's a nice positive ending to the chapter, but there are two problems. Problem number one, historically, the ending of Jerusalem's exile that's promised there, he will keep you in exile no longer, historically that proved rather underwhelming. And yes, we all know how the exile did come to an end after 70 years and Jerusalem was rebuilt, but it was never really all that phenomenal. It was all a bit of a damp squib, all a bit of an anticlimax. And then problem number two, theologically, in view of the glory of God and in view of the sheer heinousness of sin, how could it be possible that Jerusalem's punishment had been accomplished? That's the language used there in verse 22. How could her punishment possibly have been accomplished to such an extent that the exile could finish and the city could be rebuilt when God is so glorious, sin is so horrible, so ugly, so repulsive? How could you ever reach that point of accomplishment? So those are the two problems. And it seems to me then that we need to think like this. We need to always remember that the story of the Bible is not really about Jerusalem and the people of Judah, either possessing or being dispossessed of Jerusalem. No, the story of the Bible is about the human race, created for relationship with God, created for God's presence in Eden, and being dispossessed of that, being exiled from Eden. And the point of all the mini stories then about Jerusalem and Judah is, in a sense, to give vividness to that story, the Bible's ultimate story. And I guess that for much of the Old Testament, it's very easy then just to see these as two completely separate things. You have those early chapters of the Bible that describe the human race being exiled from Eden. But then you get into the story of Israel, and that seems quite separate, and it's very easy to see them as just two completely separate stories. But the point where the connection really becomes apparent is after the exile, after the Babylonian exile. Because at that point, it does become so conspicuous, doesn't it? And all the grand promises of a return, they just don't happen. As I said a moment ago, there's a return, but it's not the return the prophets had prophesied about. It's not this marching back to Zion with grandeur and with song and celebration. It's all very sad. It's all very low-key. It's all very pathetic and unremarkable. And I think the purpose of that is to emphasize that the real exile from which there needs to be a return is not that exile, not the exile of a little nation from its capital city, but the exile of mankind from the Garden of Eden, from the presence of God. It's why when you, and I don't expect you to remember this, but when we were looking at Matthew chapter 1 many, many months ago now, that genealogy, we noted in Matthew 1's genealogy something very interesting. Matthew specifically points out the people going into exile in Babylon, but he never points out the people returning from exile in Babylon. You get the impression from Matthew's genealogy that the exile's still going on. And that's because I think Matthew is saying the exile is still going on. And the purpose of the king that I'm now going to tell you about over 28 chapters is to reverse that exile and bring not a little nation back into Jerusalem, but bring Adam's race back into Eden. That's why a verse we looked at just very recently, Matthew 24, verse 31, you have that interesting language. Talking about now, I said in my interpretation, now this gospel age, he, that is Christ, the Son of Man, will send out his angels with a loud trumpet call, and they will gather his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other. That is language taken from Psalms like Psalm 147 about the regathering of the exiles after deportation in Babylon. But Matthew 24:31 is using that language of now, as the gospel goes out, people are converted, and it's like they're being gathered back from exile, gathered back to the presence of God, to Eden, to where we were created to be. And I'm saying then, verse 22, I think, here, ultimately makes the most sense when we read it not in the light of Judah and Jerusalem's little story, but in the light of the Bible's big story, when we appreciate the big picture. And when then verse 22 says that the exile is going to end, and it sounds so glorious, and yet then it seems to be belied by what actually happens in history. No, it's pointing to a better return from exile, a better ending of the exile, the ending of the ultimate exile through the work of Jesus Christ. And when then, in the first half of the verse, it talks about this return from exile happening because punishment has been accomplished. And I said, how can that be? How can punishment ever be big enough to satisfy a holy God and reverse the necessity of punishment? Well, there's the cross, isn't there? And at the cross, punishment was accomplished. And Jesus suffered hell, and he cried out, "It is finished," because punishment had been poured out sufficiently that the exile from Eden could be reversed and we could return to God. And so my question as I close then is this: are you one of the returning exiles? Not an Israelite in the first millennium BC, but are you one of the returning exiles from Eden? Are you one of those who has been gathered from the four winds through the preaching of the gospel, and King Jesus is taking you back into the place where man was created to be? Have you come home? Come home to God? Have you been brought back from your state of lostness in which you were born? Have you been brought back from exile through the work of Jesus Christ? If not, you can be. The gospel is being preached now in Matthew 24:31 terms. The angels now are seeking to gather you and bring you as an exile back to God through Jesus Christ. Will you be a returning exile? Will you come home? Will you come back to God? The punishment has been poured out on Jesus. It has been accomplished. You can return. Come to God through Jesus Christ. Amen.